Welcome to Mental Illness in Pop Culture. This week we're going to be talking about the film Wild, starring Reese Witherspoon and Laura Dern. I'm Scott.
I'm Joe.
This is Leanne.
This movie focuses quite a bit on Reese Witherspoon's character, Cheryl Strayed. She changed her name to Cheryl Strayed immediately following her divorce. And she goes on a hike it's quite long. I don't remember.
A thousand miles.
Journey of 1,000 miles begins with a divorce. And what it actually begins with is the death of her mother, played by Laura Dern. And we'll get into all of those details later. But Leanne, you had suggested this movie, and I was wondering how it came to your mind.
Well, I did see it when it was released, and I think I actually even went to the movie theater, which is quite impressive for my homebody. I'm a Reese Witherspoon fan, and I love stories that are authentically about the human journey, and so this fit. But recently, I have been watching Gilmore Girls, shamelessly, I will admit. For the first time, I was never one of those people in the early 2000s, like everybody else was. I think I boycotted it just because everybody was watching it. But I was watching Gilmore Girls a couple weeks ago, and Lorelai Gilmore has kind of this authentic moment in her, you know, adult growth, and she kind of looks around, and I think there's some questions about her life and some lack of purpose, I think. And so she makes the decision to go to the Pacific Crest Trail, much like the character in this movie, and wants to go do this walkabout. Anybody who is familiar with Gilmore Girls, and particularly her character, knows that that would never happen in a million years. She is no Cheryl from our movie. So she goes and all kinds of silliness happen. But it was foremost on my mind when we were talking about upcoming movie options, because I had just seen it in that.
And didn't she say something like, I'm going to have to do a wild? Or?
Yeah, I can't remember the wording, but she said, I'm going to have to go. Maybe it's be wild. She means be the movie, right? But be
right.
Yeah, it's cute.
Yeah. So I actually was not at all familiar with this film or Cheryl Strayed before you had mentioned that. And this movie is based on a book, and the book is autobiographical. It's a true story written by the real Cheryl Strayed. And there is a small amount of poetic license in the film, but nothing that takes away from really the main message and the events that took place in real life.
What do you think of it, Joe? You had seen it before, right?
Yeah, I have. All right, I'm going to say out front, it's not one of my favorite Reese Witherspoon movies. However, with
Legally Blonde.
I love that movie.
Okay. Me too.
But the way that she deals with her pain and, you know, in her quest of refinding herself, I think is a really beautiful and poetic representation. And the little, you know, for lack of better terms, adventures that she gets in are all quite interesting. And I think if it hadn't been for the fact that it was Reese Witherspoon and I trust her as an actor, I might not have fully gone along for the ride of the film, so to speak. Because to me, she and her performance is the heart of the film.
Yeah.
With that being said, I think there is a lot to take away from this film in terms of how to deal with depression, how to deal with feelings of guilt, loneliness, feelings of inadequacy and isolation, all those kinds of really painful and negative emotions that can come from the 1-2 punch of losing your mom and then losing your partner.
Yeah, grief from loss. I will have to say to you that I thought as I was watching this, because we just did Still Alice, that Julianne Moore would be really excellent in this role. Of course, it's a different age group, whatever. So you probably did this research because you like the background stuff so much. Yeah. But Reese Witherspoon has her own production company and bought the rights to make this movie before the book was published. So she was in and intended to produce and star in it then after that. So this is a story that really hit her as one woman's journey, both real and figuratively.
Oh, and another important point is that the director, Jean-Marc Vallée, also directs Pretty Little Lies, starring Reese Witherspoon.
That's right, which we're hoping to do on this podcast in the near future. I kind of have almost an anti-Joe reaction, which
poor
is...
Poor Joe.
That's all right.
I like Reese Witherspoon. I've never been a huge fan. I loved her in this film. I'm sold. I'm like, wow, I have underappreciated Reese, and I need to go back and rewatch some of the other films she's done.
She's great in Walk the Line.
Yeah, and so
both of these women were nominated for Best Actress and Best Supporting this year for this film.
I don't think
either won, but both were nominated from this film. So
I appreciated it was just so raw. And she said this is the most difficult film that she's ever made, partially due to the emotional content and partially due to some of the things physically that she had to do while acting, which is both involves the trail and some of the sex scenes involved. And another component is that while she was filming many of the scenes, she had no makeup on.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought she is naturally beautiful.
She is.
I did say she was the heart of the movie.
We're not roasting you. You don't have to agree. We've been told we agree too much. It's all good. So I think, and I mean, we could probably spend 8 hours on this, which I say often, but there is just so much symbolism
in
this movie. I mean, holy cow. You know, I mean, it starts, it's probably from moment one, but the one that stood out to me first when I really started realizing was the backpack.
Yes.
And the heavy and the weight. And then eventually it becomes, you know, entitled Monster. That's what she calls it. And I mean, that is such parallel to what's going on, but there's much more than that. So you're shaking your head. Seriously, tell us more. You got some in your mind?
I had that exact symbol in my notes.
Oh, gotcha.
I thought I was really clever for recognizing it.
You are.
I'm not the only one.
We're all walking around with a load.
Exactly.
Stuff, lots of stuff.
That we're carrying around on our back. There's the cliche of having a monkey on your back.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when she gets to one of the trail points, and she there's another hiker who's a little bit older gentleman, and he talks to her about taking some of the items out of her backpack
that she does not need anymore, or maybe never did.
And so I think that that's just part more of that symbolism of letting go of these things that you don't need anymore.
Exactly. That scene wouldn't have done the same justice if it had been at the beginning.
Yeah.
Some wise hiker told her to take some stuff out. There's no proof to that. She hasn't been on a part of the journey that proved what she didn't need or didn't use or shouldn't have packed or all those things. So, I mean, it's even deeper.
Which, you know, for the viewer, it's, you know, to extend the metaphor, kind of reminds you that sometimes you have to walk around with all that stuff
before you can realize
you can get rid of it.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you have to
You
have to use it, not use it, watch it collect dust or whatever before you can really truly let go. And, you know, I think examinations of people moving through the process of grief, you know, that backpack being used throughout the film as a strong metaphor for the stuff the stuff, that clinical term.
Well, I'm impressed that none of us have used baggage. So we're talking about
right.
So that's what the average person says. And not very long ago, I heard a talk by someone, I'll spare us the details, that was really looking at the use of that word baggage, which would be so appropriate for us to use, because this is equivalent of luggage, right?
Literal.
It's baggage. And I just think that stuff is more true. Yeah. You know, baggage feels like it is this heavyweight thing. But no, we just all have stuff. Some of it's a heavyweight. Some of it's just our experience. It's what makes us who we are. So I love the word stuff. Oh. It is now clinical.
And well, stuff also implies a certain randomness, mm-hmm. you know, and all of these events that happened to her just really did seem random, mm-hmm. you know, with her mom dying the way she did and her marriage falling apart and finding herself, you know, on this trek, sometimes not having a clue of where she's going or what she's doing or even to the extent of why mm-hmm. at some points, you know, there's a randomness to it all, but at the same time, that randomness is kind of, for lack of better terms, collected in all this baggage that she's carrying around on her back. I don't know if that's necessarily a sophomoric read, but...
No, I think it's...
Part of the process.
Yeah.
As a, you know, how did you read her navigating or negotiating that process of grief throughout the arc of the film?
Well, I thought that it was... That's how people do. That's what people do. Everybody grieves in the way that they grieve. And sometimes it is in healthy ways and sometimes unhealthy ways. I thought that her, you know, I believe there was a juxtaposition of the scene where she and her brother were in the hospital, found out that her mother had died. Mm-hmm. And I think right after that, we saw her, snorting or lighting up heroin, smoking heroin. And her grief was so profound that she was looking for ways to block it out, unhealthy ways, using her body sexually in a way so that there was an emptiness, a void, which I want to talk about that with her relationship with her mother, Bobby. And there were references to that. Toward the end of the film, she comes across a female hiker, a little older mm-hmm. than her, who says, you know, the trail can fill you back up. It can give you the power that you had been missing.
I think she says something along the lines of finding something inside of yourself on the trail.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that.
Yeah. Yeah, she says, I mean, look, this has the power to fill you up again if you let it. And then immediately Cheryl talks about her mother and says, my mother used to say, there's a sunrise and a sunset every day. And you could put yourself there for it, or you can put yourself in the way of beauty. And so for 4+ years, she was putting herself in the way of beauty. And now she's returning, and there's a great line in there where she says, I want to be the woman that my mother thought I was. This is the hero's journey times 10. Mm-hmm. And in addition to the hero's journey, there are so many archetypes like the wise man and the wise woman already mentioned. There are various feminine archetypes and masculine within that she encounters as she is negotiating between isolation and aloneness and connection and belonging along this process. Our previous scene where she is able to lessen her burden, I do think that's a turning point.
Agreed.
In yeah. the film.
It's the crux.
One of the things that I talk about a lot in other venues, I work with a couple of pastors that are kind of new to the leadership journey. And we always talk about, you know, I guess in counseling we say more like self-awareness sort of thing. But there is a revelation that generally comes up before restoration kind of begins, right? And so I think that's a part of what we see with Cheryl is that she knows that she's not okay when she starts yeah. this trail. You know, there's some revelation about it, but much is revealed on this next 3 months. I mean, I don't know if it's, you know, like a true mirror and she identifies with all the parts, but she certainly has some personal revelation take place on this journey. And then at the end of it, we hear about some real transforming restoration that happens in her life after this experience. So I love the idea of revelation and restoration being hand in hand.
She definitely goes through turns and moods. And I don't know. When I think about the film, I look at it from the perspective of if I knew someone or if I was going through a traumatic experience that I had to deal with, is this a film that I would watch for inspiration? Or would I recommend to someone in a similar situation to watch this film for inspirational purposes? Because I oftentimes feel like I don't think our society necessarily does a good job of exploring the idea of grief or depression or even dangerous, reckless behavior. We have a tendency of sweeping those kinds of things under the rug. And since we do that, when something, you know, like a horrific loss happens in someone's life, it's almost like they have no roadmap, you know? And I mean, we don't know what it looks like to really deal with grief, you know, on that level, you know? Grief, I'm bummed that my car got broken into. That's one thing. But I've lost these people that were fixtures in my life, that organized my life, you know? How do you deal with that, you know? I'm not necessarily saying that she dealt with it in the best way, and I definitely wouldn't necessarily recommend that anybody, just if you're dealing with something, go do a 1,100-mile walk, because I know I'm not going to.
No, that first blister would have had me in. What's interesting about what you just said is that you originally started with the idea of whether this is an inspiring story or not.
Yeah.
I can't get to that word either. We talked about the hero's journey, and at the end of it, you know, good things happen. But if I were in a super depressed stage in my life and I was, you know, watching this, it's flattened that way. There's not like these great climactic moments in the middle of it where you know everything's going to be okay.
Yeah,
and we see a lot of reckless behavior and then this literal journey that she's on. So it has an inspiring moment at the end. But if I was in a state, you know, kind of as you talked about, I don't think I would consider this an inspiring thing to watch in that moment,
yeah.
I guess, if I were truly.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was interesting because I felt like the film definitely ended on an upswing, but the film didn't feel finished.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is so much more to this story. Not in the sense that, you know, it's turning into a Hollywood setup where, oh, of course, you know, there's going to be a wild part two. Not in that sense,
right.
But in the sense that this character, Cheryl, there's more to come.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think you can kind of safely assume that she's ultimately okay in the end because, of course, she wrote the source material.
Yeah, right.
But
I think that what you do feel through the whole thing is that sense of hopefulness.
Yeah.
Like you hope that this is going to be a journey where the other side is different, right, for her in her life.
Because, well, I mean, it's easy to root for her, too, right? You know,
yeah.
Just as a you know, I know Cheryl's a real person, but as a
character. She was heroic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she as a Cheryl Strayed in real life, I think, is more or less the body type of Reese Witherspoon. She made it through parts of that trail that experienced rugged hikers that they did not.
The snow stuff.
And she was a novice. And the things, but her determination, her perseverance, her stick-to-itness, and water is a strong symbol throughout the film. And the film ends with her arriving at this bridge. She's going to cross the bridge into the rest of her life. And I want to go back to the inspiration part. I don't know that somebody in the throes of grief, this would be a film for them. But I haven't thought about it. Maybe I would think that. I do find it inspiring. And I'm going to read three parts that I think were meant to be three iterations of the same concept. The first comes from, and by the way, I love the overlay of the scenes in this film. The first comes when she's reading something from Marie Curie, the scientist who I think discovered radium. And then it transitions into the college where both Cheryl and her mother, Bobby, they're both taking classes. And we hear about Marie Curie, and it's a metaphor. She died a famous woman, denying her wounds. Denying her wounds came from the same source as her power.
I did write that.
Now a quote from Bobby, when Cheryl has just said, "You're all so happy all the time, and how can that be? You were married to this a-hole alcoholic." And Bobby says, "Do I regret marrying an abusive alcoholic asshole? No, not for one second. Because I got you, and I got your brother." And then almost at the end of the film, Cheryl is reflecting back on this 4+ years of hell and then the 1,000-mile journey. And she says, well, actually, this is precipitated by running into a grandmother and her young grandson, Kyle, who sings this beautiful song that concludes or has a chorus, "Just remember the Red River Valley and the cowboy that loved you so true." So she moves away from them. She just breaks down crying. And I think it's her final moment of healing. And that theme of El Condor Pasa by Simon and Garfunkel starts up again. Mm-hmm. And she says, what if I could go back? What if I could forgive myself? What if I was sorry? But I wouldn't go back and change. What if I learned from heroin and et cetera? And all those things got me here. Her source of power is also her source of wounds. And they're essential, just like her mother was saying that she wouldn't give up having been with this jerk of a guy because she got her children and her happiness from that. Wow, that was a long monologue.
You were passionate. I couldn't see your hands, but the hands were going. Well, I obviously agree. I mean, I'm in a crazy transition period in my life, and it's been a little weird, and some of it has been a little rough. And you know, we have those moments as humans where we look around and there can be a little self-pity show up for a hot second and like, what is going on here and what's wrong? And I'll spare the details, but I've got a bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. And a part of what I'm looking at that I'm super excited to move into is based in some horrific moments in my life. Like this thing that I might get to go do, this change in my life, I wouldn't be able to understand it if some really awful things hadn't happened when I was younger. And I'm being unclear, but so I'm a choir for that one. I agree.
Well, I mean, it's a really important fact about the human condition. Oftentimes, the things that seem most painful in our lives are actually the gateway to the most pleasure. And I don't necessarily mean that in the sexual sense, because I recognize that.
Thanks for the clarity. No, yeah. We're not going there.
You know, the idea that, you know, through tragedy comes, you know, more glorious feelings and experiences, an important point, you know. I mean, that's a heck of a quote, you know. Tragedy always is like the root of growth, you know. There's that cliche that, how does it go? Everything happens for a reason, even when you don't know what that reason is, mm-hmm. You know. And through that loophole essentially, we have these really, really, really painful experiences that ultimately become something
purposeful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's a pretty powerful quote to say that I don't have regrets about marrying an abusive asshole because I got my babies.
Yeah.
You know, which, I don't know, depending on who you are and when you're having that conversation, you know, there are some people that can look at a sentiment like that and say you're delusional. And there are others that'll look at a sentiment like that and say that's a pretty empowered way of looking at painful experiences in one's life.
I was having a conversation with another mom the other day, and we were talking about some of the decisions just that our kids make, but we were specifically talking about our teenagers make. And we were discussing the idea of, you know, how protective we feel of our kids, and we don't want them to have pain, and we don't, you know, we just, we're really protective. I mean, that's kind of part of it, right? That's what we do. And we went into a conversation about how, you know, I mean, nothing tragic, but allowing for a little bit of that is how they learn. I mean, really protecting and doing that is how they learn. So it's through tragedy, it's through pain that, I mean, that's a part of our identity.
Yeah.
It's how we're developed.
The scars make you beautiful.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's a fairly common sentiment. And also, one of the things we talk about in counseling is what happens later changes the meaning to you of what happened earlier. Mm-hmm. And the classic example I give in my classes is I'll say, like, who here has been through a horrible breakup that you just thought it was the end of the world? And the whole class raises their hand. And then I say, who now, looking back, thinks, thank God I dodged the bullet? And the whole class raises their hand again.
Hindsight.
And I think that gives hope also. Mm-hmm. Knowing, like, yeah, I've been here before and I made it through and it turned out okay, that helps me make it through.
Well, yeah, and it also feeds in this idea of, you know, which is also really heavily evident in the film, the notion of redemption.
Yes.
You know, I mean, even though she continues to make mistakes, right, both as a human being and as a hiker, she still has the ability to make change.
Yeah.
And become another person or become a better iteration of herself. And I think that's a really, and that's a part of the reason why I was asking, you know, would I show this movie to someone who's going through a similar right. experience? Because one of the things that's important about the film is that it does reiterate this notion that, look, you can be at the lowest point, but don't despair too much, because just with a few shifts, meeting a few different people along your path, can move you into a completely new direction and a new sense of a new sense of self. The film does a really wonderful job at showing that even if you continue to make mistakes as both a human being and as a hiker, just by meeting a person here, a person there, it can teach you so much more. And oftentimes, and I think if I'm remembering everything correctly, a lot of the really direction-changing characters that Cheryl meets that say these small comments, these really seemingly completely random statements that, of course, are, you know, full of gravity, aren't necessarily from the most compelling characters that she meets. You know, it's in the small spaces, you know, and I think that that's a really important thing for people to remember. Because I feel like perhaps because of popular culture, we have this idea that there's going to be this one person that's going to come in and save our lives, you know, in whatever scenario we might find ourselves. But the reality is that that's rarely how it works. You know, you hear something from an old friend calls out of nowhere and reminds you about days gone by and better, lighter times. And then the next day, someone says a throwaway line on an elevator or acknowledges you in a different way that you hadn't been before. So, you know, oftentimes we have these much smaller moments, you know, we're rarely ever rescued by one person. I mean, that comes along and it's one dynamic person that rescues you from your pit of depression or what have you. But the reality is that more often than not, it's smaller, more discrete instances, things that just happen to you throughout the course of your day, over weeks, over months. And I think that's really emblematic and reflective of what, of Cheryl's journey, of her own quest, in that oftentimes it's not a major event that shifts her way of thinking and her way of seeing the world and herself. It's these really smaller statements that she hears from people or seeing something.
Speaking of seeing something, we've got some symbolism also as it relates to animals that are showing up. One is this really strange looking fox. Does anybody else think it's a strange looking fox? I mean, it's almost like a generated. It almost looks like a character of some kind. And then we repeatedly see scenes of her with her mom with a horse that's obviously Bobby's.
Yes.
And then sort of, I guess, indicate that it has something wrong with it. It's some kind of disease thing. And then we see horses show up in other places in the movie. So what you could
think? Well, and Cheryl and her husband, Paul, literally right before they get divorced, on the way to getting divorced, they get horses tattooed to continue to bond them together, which happened in real life also. Side note, fun trivia, the tattoo artist was played by Art Alexis, lead singer of the band Everclear.
Are you so excited?
Yeah.
Problems. Oh, hey, the little blonde Cheryl, whenever they're showing her pretty young, like 5 or 6 years old, is actually Cheryl's real daughter in real life. Did you see that already on there? Yeah.
So first the fox.
Yeah.
I thought the fox symbolized her mother, Bobby.
Yeah. I did some reading and research just about the fox because I didn't want to miss anything. And so I think that that's what you would assume. Some of the writings that, and again, I think this is still the same answer, but really identified it just as her strength showing up.
Oh, okay.
And I loved that thought too. But getting strength from Bobby, I mean, that kind of fits as well. Her relationship with her mom is turning into a strength place instead of a grief place. And so I think there's kind of both.
Yeah. And I saw it kind of paralleling how after her mother has died and she goes to counseling, or we can talk about that in a second. And then she leaves the counselor's office and she sees her mother standing in the corridor of the office building.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw this as a parallel to the fox, but I like the strength better.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the horse?
Well, we have the horse with the mom, and I was really caught off guard when the mom says, just do the
right thing,
kindest thing.
Yeah.
Where she says that, I didn't get it. I didn't realize before that in my mind that the horse was ill. I didn't understand that part. It didn't hit me that way. And so I kind of had to catch up at that point. So I don't know what I think about it. I really don't. And then we see the horse later in the, when she's camping, the white one, when it's raining. And then she has a connection with that horse. So you're going to have to get profound on your analyzation of that for me, because I don't have much for the horse.
Well, I could speculate. And then there's also when she comes across, you know, these small characters that she encounters with the grandmother and her grandchild.
And has the, yeah.
And I don't know what that was, like an alpaca or something.
Alpaca, but llama.
Llama or something.
I think it's an alpaca.
It seemed like it had transformed. So, but I saw horses, the horse as symbolizing combination of strength, kindness, and vulnerability, maybe. You know, I know that within counseling, there's this concept of equestrian therapy, which is very popular, very powerful, and that horses are so sensitive to what's going on with the people around them, and they then reflect that emotion.
It's also, you know, going down the rabbit hole with it, it's also, you know, a symbol of freedom, you know?
Oh, well, that's it.
Okay.
We just need a doctor.
Joe wins.
Merry Christmas. That's it. Well, there's got to be tons to it. And I was really trying to, you know, because her mom says, do the kindest thing possible. So I was trying to think, is that like her mom telling her to be kind to herself, to be kind to Cheryl? I mean, I was trying to do what that message would be that would mean something for Cheryl, and I couldn't. But you are there. You got it.
And one thing that Bobby said to Cheryl that seemed like just such a strong message is, Cheryl, if there's one thing I could teach you, it's how to find your best self and hold on to it.
But when did she say that to her?
That is when, that is in the scene where there is, the son is in there and she asks his friend Wayne if he's going to stay for dinner, I think. Okay. And maybe it's also when Cheryl has confronted her mom about having had this abusive alcoholic husband. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of making sense of it. I want to touch on a couple more things. You know, you can lead a horse to
the water.
Yeah. Which was just such a prominent symbol. Call me the master of the Segway. Just rampant water, like visually water present at key junctures throughout the film and when meeting so many of these people. And I love the music of this. And so often the music that is playing is reflective of what's happening in the film. But just listen to the water that's in the songs. We've got Texas Flood by Stevie Ray Vaughan, Box of Rain,
Grateful Dead,
and Ripple in Stillwater. And probably the ultimate, Suzanne by Leonard Cohen, which talks about Suzanne takes you to the water. And then it talks about Jesus was a sailor. And I did cheat and look at somebody's interpretation online who interprets Suzanne as being a song about a maternal archetype. Mm-hmm. And with the water even being related to the womb, I don't know if I would go that far.
Life-giving.
And I do know from majoring in Spanish literature that water is often a symbol of life in literature. And it's just so prevalent throughout this. And it also has a cleansing property. Now, my personal way that I relate to this thousand-mile incredibly arduous journey that Cheryl took. There have been times when I have been experiencing quite a bit of stress and anxiety over things that have happened. And my way of dealing with it has been to go running. And it's because I'm trying to cleanse my body of all those stress chemicals that are running through it. And there, you know, there's a cliche, you're always only one run away from a good mood. And it does have a healing power. And there's also the prevalent metaphor that we all kind of operate according to, which is life is a journey. And so we understand our life with the same properties that we use to understand journeys.
If I could, I looked up the soundtrack. Other songs include, I won't name any that you just named, Walk Unafraid by First Aid Kit, Let Him In,
Paul McCartney, Wings, yeah.
I Can Never Go Home Anymore by Shangri-La's, Don't Be Cruel by Billy Swan, Be My Friend by Free, Something About What Happens When by Lucinda Williams, Tougher Than the Rest by Bruce Springsteen. Yeah. Are You Going With Me, Pat Metheny Group. The Air That I Breathe, The Hollies. Homeward Bound, Spiral, Simon and Garfunkel.
And she does.
You know, it's just, I think that's, a lot of people don't necessarily think about soundtracks to films like these, you know, because, you know, the music isn't necessarily, music wasn't necessarily used to market the film, and it's not necessarily a source of the film in that regard. But good filmmaking always pays attention to the songs.
We always think it's another character in the show. It's another character. There's a feel it creates.
Absolutely. And I loved the use of Glory Box by Portishead. Yeah. And then there was a slight reference to the kitschy song What's Up by Four Non Blondes.
Which, you know, I mean, all these songs, you know, just by the title alone show you that the filmmakers were very, very concerned with keeping this thread of water, of doing the right thing, of cleansing, creating friendships, all woven throughout the entire text of the film. It's a good movie. Good movie. Not my favorite Reese Witherspoon movie.
Right.
For the record.
All right, next week is Legally Blonde.
Wow. Legally Blonde 2.
Two.
Yeah.
So, not giving my hour for that.
So thank you for listening to Mental Illness in Pop Culture. You can check us out all over social media. Our webpage and all of our episodes can be found at mentalillnessinpopculture.podomatic.com. We're also available through iTunes or whatever your favorite app of choice is. We have a Twitter account, which I believe is MINPC5. We're on Facebook, Mental Illness and Pop Culture. And we also have a Gmail account, mentalillnessinpopculture@gmail.com.